inspiring conversations for the modern man. The Evolving Man Podcast.
Right. I am sitting with a man named Gareth Moxie, and thanks for coming on the show, Gareth. We're going to talk about the opiate epidemic, and we're going to talk about some methods of healing opiate addiction that people might not know about and that I think people need to know about. I've talked a lot on this show about addiction and recovery. I've also talked about psychedelics. We'll drop into that today as well. And thanks for taking the time to sit down with me and educate
people. You're quite
welcome. On this subject. So maybe just tell people a little bit about what you do, and we'll get into it.
Hi. I'm Gareth. I operate Inner Realms Center with my girlfriend and partner, Blair Bromley. Our main focus of the work we do is working with Ibogaine help people through opioid detox. Ibogaine's a powerful plant medicine, and it's particularly efficient for opiate detoxes or addiction interruption.
Yeah, okay. And I think everybody knows someone right now who's struggled or is struggling with opiate addiction, because mm-hmm. there's been this massive explosion over the last mm-hmm. 10, maybe 15 years of oxycodone and OxyContin mm-hmm. in North America. And I mean, I've watched countless documentaries mm-hmm. About it, and I've had definitely over 10 people in my sphere die mm-hmm. from this. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe it's become... most definitely it's become a more deadly thing because of the presence of fentanyl on the market.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
Right. So we have this, you know, 20 years ago, there were heroin addicts out there mm-hmm. and there were people who were addicted to painkillers like morphine. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about multiple things here. There's that addiction mm-hmm. that existed previously, but now we've stacked a couple mm-hmm. things on top mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. We've got the prescription medication that came out, OxyContin and oxycodone, and addiction rates went through the roof. It was overprescribed. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, we had fentanyl enter mm-hmm. the market, which is a very powerful anesthetic mm-hmm. and very easy to overdose on. And it started yes. being mixed in mm-hmm. with a lot of things, anything mm-hmm. that's got white powder, basically. Mm-hmm. And people started accidentally taking fentanyl and dying.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you've seen that as well with the...
Yeah. People. Yeah. Well, the whole opioid thing, I'm from the UK, and in the 80s, we saw an explosion of heroin that came to Britain. I mean, there's been heroin around for a long time. We had an explosion in the 80s, which came through from the war in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that Obviously, set yes. A lot of opium production going on in Afghanistan. And I think also another problem they had there from war is that their infrastructure got blown apart. And so it's very difficult for them to have other agricultural production.
Yeah.
And also they had a problem, I think, with drought. And so opium production went up and up and up from that time. And then there was another wave that happened with the oxycodone, the overprescribing of oxycodone, mm-hmm. which basically in a lot of respects kind of put... an opioid painkiller that has the same kind of euphoria as heroin into a lot of people's medicine cabinets.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So, yeah, we're going to talk about that some more. We're going to talk about opiate addiction. We're going to talk about novel ways to detox and recover from opiate addiction mm-hmm. because it's very complicated. Mm-hmm. But you know what? First, I'd really like to hear some pieces about your story and how you got into this work, because mm-hmm. Actually, I've never asked a person who's working with addicts mm-hmm. what their story is, and never, just been swept up in the story. It's always such an interesting story. So how did you get into helping heroin addicts? This is such an intense population to work with, right? So
yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, I recovered from alcohol with LSD myself. And so that was really the first interest. I had a problem with drugs and alcohol from a young age. I moved to England when I was young, from Canada. Alcohol is very prevalent in Europe. It's almost like a cultural obligation, if you will. And right. So, I just found myself as one of those people that would, you know, find themselves drinking too much, getting involved in drugs. I'd gotten involved in harder drugs when I was younger, intravenous amphetamine use, and some opiate use. But it always kind of came back to alcohol, which was the one that seemed to kick my ass the hardest, if you will.
So you were using intravenous drugs at some point, mm-hmm. but alcohol yeah. was kind of your what they call the drug of choice mm-hmm. In mm-hmm. recovery circles.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, oddly enough, I think my psychedelic use, when I was younger, the psychedelics were kind of just some other drugs that we were using at the time.
Right.
You know, it seemed they all kind of...
It's all drugs, right?
It's just yeah, like, it was just drugs. And yeah. also being a young age, I don't think that I really had the mental capacity to really understand the spiritual aspects mm-hmm. that psychedelics can offer. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're younger, it's all about having a laugh and watching the walls drip kind of thing on yeah. LSD and that kind of stuff. So, but I found that after the intravenous drug use and inner city use, I got involved with the a phenomena in the 80s in Britain called the Peace Convoy, which was part of the Free Festival movement, uh-huh. which is kind of like Deadheads, if yeah. you will, yeah. in Britain, living in buses and yeah. trucks. And we weren't following the Grateful Dead, but it was a similar kind of thing. And we would travel around and have free festivals and stuff. So that was really my introduction into psychedelics. And it was through a lot of psychedelic use in the summertime that I realized that, you know, intravenous amphetamine use was probably something that I really shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
You know, so that kind of me getting out of that kind of drug use really just came about through more psychedelic drug use, and I think, and it just kind of happened by default as I look back on that.
Right. So it didn't happen. I mean, the way that people, I think, envision it happening these days is you intentionally go to some kind of ceremony to have a mental breakthrough.
Right.
Like, oh, I want to like wake up, you know?
Right.
And, I mean, people come to me for that. And, mm-hmm. But for you, you just happened to be like deeply in mm-hmm. a few trips and connected to, some deeper wisdom that mm-hmm. that helped you move away from that mm-hmm. stuff. Like, oh, I'm profoundly connected right now. And I realize that when I'm on amphetamines, I'm just a gerbil on a mm-hmm. on a wheel mm-hmm. running.
Well, it was an interesting time. It was in the early 80s. That was the time of Thatcher. And I left school at a time of a lot of unemployment, and there didn't really seem to be much to be looking forward to.
Right.
You know, so it was very easy to fall into inner city drug use and yeah. stuff. And then going through the free festivals and falling in with the, as they were known back then, the Peace Convoy. And I kind of ran away with the psychedelic gypsies, if
yeah,
you will.
Right.
And the free festival community.
Was this like... You could go to one of these festivals that they put on and there was just like as many drugs as you want to consume?
Well, Stonehenge was our main festival yeah. of the year. And that was the one that really kicked it off at the beginning of June.
Yeah.
And I used to live in a place called Sherborne, Dorset, which was about 40 miles from Stonehenge.
Okay.
And so I remember as a kid, my father used to live quite close to there. And I remember going to visit him, and I was about 13 or something, and we were stopped in the main street there, and I saw all of these buses, And all of these people getting out, and they had dreadlocks and stuff. And I was looking at them thinking, who are these people?
Yeah.
And my dad, I remember my dad saying, oh, don't take any notice of them. They're just the hippies from Stonehenge.
Right.
You know, and so I didn't think much about it. And of course, later I discovered Stonehenge Festival. You know, I started smoking pot, and then we went to Stonehenge. And back then, well, in Britain, it's a little bit different. The cops don't have guns.
Oh.
All right. So it's a much more level playing field.
Yeah.
And so so the peace convoy, or the main part of the free festival community, really was like an anarchist community living in vehicles,
mm-hmm.
and protection in numbers.
Yeah.
And so they would travel around in these old buses. It was like a third world thing.
Yeah.
Going down the road with people with goats and chickens and in many respects, it was unemployed culture as well, unemployed kind of hippie drug culture. And so I just got swept up with that.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed so much healthier than being in unemployed inner city, heavy drug use and stuff. So I kind of ran off with those guys. And that kind of heavy drug use was kind of frowned upon,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so there was people in that community, elders, if you will, that had come from the Isle of Wight Festival. This is how this phenomena started. I think they had a festival in Windsor in 1970, and everybody just kind of left in vehicles off to the next one. And then they realized, oh, we should live in buses. And
let's just do
it all the time. And in Britain, there's gypsies and different travelers that live on the road. So it really just became a different subset, a different traveler community that lived on the road with different traveler types.
Yeah, I think that's probably been a phenomenon of one or another type ever since vehicles were... Maybe since the 60s, you know, like, I mean, now people live in vans and there's like this whole van life thing.
Oh,
this
life
community.
Yeah,
right?
But
I think it probably also happens with burners. Mm-hmm. You know, they go to Burning Man and it changes their life. And they're like, well, why can't Burning Man be all the time?
Yeah. Sure.
So you had this awakening on psychedelics that helped you get off amphetamines. Mm-hmm. And when did the awakening around alcohol happen?
It always been there, and I did that whole festival thing for years, and then I left that in the late 80s, and the 89 was my last year of festivals, and I left Britain then. I cut my dreadlocks off. I got a one-way ticket to Taiwan, and I started to teach English there. Just ABCs and stuff to little kids. I'd had an opiate problem in the last couple of years that I'd been living in Britain. And, not an overly serious one,
mm-hmm.
but a one that led to a dependency.
Yeah.
I wasn't drinking so much. I found things a little bit easier in some respects, taking opiates. As opposed to drinking, it was less chaotic,
right?
And it from is the less chaotic. Yes, and from the outside, actually, my life seemed to kind of come together in some respects.
Yeah, in some ways, it's like it seems like opiate addiction is more manageable in terms of being able to like be around other people mm-hmm. and you know sort of quote lead a regular life, like mm-hmm. go to work and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas if you're drunk.
Yeah, you know, it holds a lot of promise, you know, in the beginning. Opiates do hold a lot of promise, and they cover a lot of bases.
Mm-hmm.
Social anxiety, all kinds of things. You know, people with all kinds of different things going on, opiates really do cover a lot of bases. Physical pain, emotional pain.
Exactly. It takes away your pain and still gives you the ability to function, mm-hmm. move around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
So... yeah, so you booked the ticket to Taiwan.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, so I actually weaned off of opiates. I went to Taiwan, and I did okay there. I was teaching English and stuff. And but after a period of time, I managed to find opiates there over the counter. and stuff, and I had an opiate relapse a long way away from home. While I'd been there, though, I had to leave the country every couple of months, and I'd gone down to the Philippines, and I'd done a bit of scuba diving down there, and I'd always been very keenly interested in scuba diving, and so with the help of my father, actually, when I'd had an opiate relapse in Taiwan, my family wanted me to come back to Britain and go to rehab, and that I just didn't think that that was gonna work. And they helped me go to the Philippines, and I got diving qualifications up to dive master, and so I stayed in the Philippines, and there's no opiates in the Philippines, so I stayed clean from opiates and was doing quite well there for some time. But you know, addiction is addiction, and then alcohol came in, and then also methamphetamine, and so.
So they had methamphetamine there.
Yes,
they just had no opiates.
Yeah, and I'd had, you know, I'd had an amphetamine thing. I have attention deficit disorder, and so being pulled in by amphetamines was actually, you know, it's a kind of a natural thing. Anyhow,
me too. I found I've been diagnosed with ADD, and and I was put on Ritalin and Dextrin when I was younger, and it just kind of calmed me down and like took away my appetite. So yeah, I have a little bit of a different reaction to caffeine even than my roommates do.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can relate to that. It's like, I know what you're talking about with the natural piece. Like, you know, Gabor Mate talks about how, you know, so many people with ADD end up self-medicating.
Yeah.
This is the term, self-medicating with stimulants, because stimulants actually help your brain compensate for, you know, whatever overfunctioning or underfunctioning is occurring. So you're in the Philippines, alcohol and amphetamines is an issue.
Yeah. I had help from friends there. They kind of bundled me on a plane and sent me back to Britain, said, don't come back until you've got your shit together. So that was when I first did the traditional rehabilitation thing, you know, and tried that, you know. So, which, you know, like most people, you know, you think, well, I'm going to go off to rehab and then I'm going to be quote unquote cured or whatever.
Yeah,
it is when you think, you know, it's part of your experience of addiction.
You think it's just going to do it for you, right? Like, rehab's going to like get me to where I need to go.
Yeah.
In some ways, I think there's this expectation, especially when you're an addict, that like you're just going to get some kind of a magic pill,
right?
Because that's what you're used to.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, that was a bit of a rude awakening, really. You know, it's not as easy as one might think. And so, you know, I went back there. I did that for a period of time. I think I left the rehab and went and scored some over-the-counter opiates and a couple of beers and stuff. But I was like, yeah, no, I've got this, you know.
This was like, did you like, quote, graduate? Like you finished the program?
No. I did my 30 days and thought that I'd had it, even, you know, I'd got this, you know, and even though I went and scored afterwards. And then I went back to the Philippines and made everybody's life hell for a few more years, you know, before I left and kind of fucked things up good and proper there, you know. So, but that's where I discovered the program, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. I had gone to a rehabilitation place in Britain, but I'd gone to one. They'd done an evaluation of me and figured that I wouldn't do very well with 12-step and stuff. So the rehab I'd gone to was not a 12-step rehab. It was run by an old ex-Hell's Angel and stuff, and he had his own program.
Yeah, right.
So it
as an alternative. Yeah,
as an alternative.
Yeah.
But I discovered Alcoholics Anonymous on Boracay Island in the Philippines, actually, and that was when I first went to an AA meeting. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I think people assume that the AA program is pretty much like a North America and you know, maybe the UK.
Well, there were no Filipinos there.
Right.
I'd gone to AA in Thailand as well, and there were no Thais in any of the meetings either. So
I remember I've been to meetings all over the world too, and it's similar. Okay, so you decided like, okay, I'm ready to check out this program, because I'm assuming you were desperate enough.
Well, yeah,
you needed.
I would have the, you know, it would be cyclical where I'd get my shit together and, you know, get hired by another dive shop, you know, and I'd be working quite well for a bit, and then the instructor would go missing and be found face down in the sand,
right,
first thing in the morning when I'm supposed to be in the classroom,
right. You
know? Yeah. So yeah.
You're not safe to dive today, sir.
Yeah, no, it gotten quite ridiculous, you know.
So,
and also, it's not a good industry to be involved in. The tourist industry, because everybody, you know, a lot of people like to party and dive, you know, because they're on holiday and stuff, and it's not really.
Yeah, I see.
Get caught up in all of that.
There's very little accountability in any sort of industry that involves partying for an addict.
Right? Yeah, yeah, it's exactly.
Like, in some ways, it's a perfect industry for an addict because you can just hide your
addiction, totally,
like being a bartender as an alcoholic.
Uh-huh, yeah. I was drinking in the morning and stuff, and taking people diving.
Yeah.
You know, I would have to drink rum in my coffee in the morning. Otherwise, I'd be shaking. And I'd be like, my brain wouldn't function. So,
yeah.
At one point, I was drinking a flat, you know, a little flat I could have in my back pocket. I could, I'd drink one of those and chew gum in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, we've established that you were a legitimate alcoholic and addict.
Yes. So DTs and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So what brings you to the acid trip that blows your mind?
Eventually, moving to the States with my girlfriend Nancy, she introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I think, you know, I was bouncing along for a couple of years of going to AA and not. And so I would string certain amounts of time together and then relapse.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't fully doing the Alcoholics Anonymous program, I guess.
But you were starting to, some of it was starting to penetrate your mind, right?
Yeah,
like
sure.
Acknowledging the problem, acknowledging you can't do it on your own.
Yeah.
And that some of the format of the steps, like clearing your past, et cetera,
was
in there.
Yes. But there was, you know, there was somewhat resistance with Alcoholics Anonymous as well. And then also cannabis is important to me. That's my kind of go-to for attention deficit.
Mm-hmm.
It's my medicine. Mm. And so whenever I was in the program, I wasn't using cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I would get to a point where I'd just relapse with alcohol.
Yeah.
And then that whole cycle would happen again. And, you know, I'd have a beer and be drunk for another 6 months. And then, you know, so.
So what the acid trip.
Okay, sorry. Yes, the acid trip. Well, I had had several months sobriety, but I could feel that, you know, that wild hair up my ass. I could feel a relapse coming. I could just sense it and we often do when something like that's about to happen. And I was in Marin County then. I was living in Northern California, just on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Okay.
And I was at a friend's house. Some LSD just happened to pass in front of me. So I said, I think I should take that. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And then I kind of set up the session because I knew about the stuff that had gone on in Saskatchewan, you know, with Dr. Humphrey Osmond and how they first started using LSD at a hospital there in Saskatchewan in the 1950s. And so
I didn't know it was in Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And so I kind of set the trip up with some music. I didn't use headphones, but I had speakers on either side of me, a candle, and it was just all about going in.
Yeah.
And I'd taken LSD an awful lot before, but there had always been externalities. It had been at festivals.
Yeah.
I used to sell it a lot at festivals and stuff. So.
Different context.
Yes.
Right.
And it was all about the intention to break free from this fucking thing with alcohol that had just been going on and on and on and on. And I was 35 by this point.
Yeah. Okay.
And so within about 4 hours of that LSD experience, I just knew that my relationship with alcohol was over.
Wow.
And it was really quite simple, and it's something I'd heard before at Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, you know, this old guy used to say, "Well, Gareth, you know, if you don't drink, you can't get drunk."
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of it was almost as simple as that. Like,
yeah,
if you just don't fucking drink, life will be awesome.
Yeah,
just get it into your fucking thick head.
Right,
and it did, and it has been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. I mean, that wasn't, you know, of course, it's been a work in progress, and that was it'll be 20 years ago in August.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, congratulations.
Well, that was the beginning of, you know, a really kind of healing,
yeah,
you know, because I was always finding myself coming back to that situation of falling back into alcohol, and you just can't really grow from that
place. Yeah, so I want to talk about that piece, because... there is this, like, if you don't drink, you can't get drunk, mm-hmm, thing,
mm-hmm,
which is actually hard for addicts. You're really talking about acceptance. Like,
right,
I cannot drink, mm-hmm, at a very, very deep level. Mm-hmm. Acceptance in your heart at the depth of your being. Like, I don't drink anymore. I cannot drink.
Yeah.
This body does not work with alcohol, period. I'm never drinking.
Right.
You know, like, to get that level of surrender to that reality, mm-hmm, for an addict is, it's very hard to break through the layers, mm-hmm, of denial and the layers of excuses and, yeah, like, wow, maybe one day, yeah, and all this shit, right?
Yeah, no, it just can't happen.
So there was something, what I'm getting is that there was something there in that acid trip that allowed you to, like, go right to the core of your belief structure around alcohol plus you, and that alcohol plus you equals not working. Life is death. Not working. Death.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so
I had that, like, countless times I'd had that understanding, and that whole thing with the AA, you know, that, like, go there and disease, and oh, my disease, this, my name.
Yes.
So, like, I knew all that. I knew I couldn't drink, but it was feeling in it and having that acceptance,
because
mm-hmm, I've never had an alcohol craving since then. It's not, uh-huh, something that ever really enters. And also, since Ibogaine, I've never had an opiate craving either.
You know, okay, so yeah, I want to get to the Ibogaine, yeah, too. So there was a profound shift there that occurred for you.
Yeah.
At a programming level. I mean, I can't remember who came on Joe Rogan's podcast, but he told a couple stories of working with acid and getting rid of his allergies.
Oh, okay.
He played with a cat. Well, I'm allergic to cats too, so I'm, mm-hmm, tempted to drop a bunch of acid and play with the cat because, uh-huh, I really want to heal that. But he...
be a lot of fun as well.
But when he was younger, he was playing with a cat and he was like, he wasn't even consciously trying to heal his allergy. It just something happened. The acid opened up a gateway in, mm-hmm, the program. Because that's how it really, an allergy seems to be, is like this sort of like faulty program where your body thinks that the allergen is bad, but it's not. It just, mm, sort of like creates, it's like a bug in the system.
Mm.
And so he sort of like reprogrammed that bug. And in some ways I see that in what you're saying, where you already knew the program you wanted to write. You'd been trying to write it,
mm,
over the code for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then
I was suddenly feeling it.
Yeah. You got it,
yeah,
in there.
Yeah.
So that, I obviously, that's like,
and that was even before the end of the trip. Like, it was within those first 4 hours, you know, and then the rest, yeah, of the trip was like, oh, okay,
yeah,
you know, I just knew it was done, and I knew that it was done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the second piece is what I think people need to understand is there's a couple layers that will equate to long-term sobriety for someone. And the first one is this like profound, deep acceptance of the, mm, reality of things.
Mm-hmm.
But the second piece is learning how to deal with the stress that tends to lead you to relapse. And in some ways you need to do both, right? Mm-hmm. Because I mean, you can cling on for dear life and white knuckle with the realization that, like, okay, alcohol doesn't work for me. But, mm-hmm, if you don't know how to deal with stress, if you don't learn how to deal with stress,
mm-hmm,
you'll be miserable. You'll, mm-hmm, be a miserable sober person.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you learn to deal with stress in your life when you had that same sort of thing come up?
There have been some shifts. There's some shifts. Okay, I started using cannabis again.
Yeah.
Which, without alcohol, it was profoundly different if I'm just using cannabis. And then also, I found my community again. I found Burning Man community.
Ah.
And I'd come from the festival community in Britain, which was very, in some respects, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And then we found the Burning Man community. So I found my people, if you will, in some respect. You know, I found something I could connect with. And that's a psychedelic community. And so, you know, I've always enjoyed psychedelics. But it was, I don't know, finding community, getting involved in art, getting involved in something more than just the grind,
mm-hmm.
you know, because that's really what it had been up to that point. Moving to the States with my girlfriend, you know, it was all great being with her and moving to the States and stuff, but I hadn't found my community.
Yeah.
And it was very easy to fall in with the Burning Man community because it was just really an extension of something that I'd been doing in Britain the years before.
Mm-hmm.
It was slightly different. The Peace Convoy was kind of like Deadheads with the big injection of class war.
Yeah, right.
It's a very British thing. Yeah. So, you know, it's a bit more edgy and then living, I was living at this point in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, the community was all around me. I just didn't know that. And as soon as I found them, I was like, oh my God.
Mm-hmm. And a little more like inclusive and
Totally. Let's
say nice than the previous community that you'd have been a part of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's amazing that you shared that. Because I often say how important it is for people to find a community where they really feel connected and seen and loved and understood.
Mm-hmm.
And that being just a key to finding long-term recovery. And, you know, that's why I often say that, you know, no one recovers alone because, in essence, addiction is rooted in some kind of disconnection from the self and disconnection from others, you know, whether it's a traumatic experience, it results in an experience for the person that they feel disconnected from the world and disconnected from themselves.
Yep.
And the process of recovery is reversing that,
finding
connection in yourself, finding out who you are and like, you know, learning to be comfortable and happy in your body, relatively.
Mm-hmm.
And finding reconnection in other people. And I think that's one of the reasons why AA is so useful for people because you go and you find a community of people who are on the same path as you and there's an acceptance there. And it's also can be challenging because every AA group is different. So you you have to find your people.
Yeah.
But, in the end, what you need is to find your people. Sure. So, so that's really great that you found the burner community.
Yeah.
So where does Ibogaine come into the picture?
Oh, okay. So I'd had this thing. It'd been about 6 years, I think, from when I first went to traditional rehab to actually taking LSD, or 5 years or something, and taking that LSD with the intention of combating my alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stopped going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the time of getting into the internet, I seem to recall. So then I had a lot of information at my fingertips. And I'd known about Iboga. I had a huge psilocybin trip when I was like 16 or 17 with my buddy Ed, and which totally woke me up to this new world. And so we had a really good bookstore in our town, and I went and got two books from there. One of them was The Great Books of Hashish by Lawrence Cherniak,
okay,
which is an awesome coffee table book of hashish around the world. And the other one was Plants of the Gods, Albert Hoffman and Richard Schultes, I think, that wrote that one. And so I found out about Iboga way back then, you know, and I knew about Iboga, not Ibogaine, but Iboga. And So after my LSD experience, and I knew about LSD, how it had been used for alcoholics, mm-hmm. but after I had come out of this experience and a new me, I was like, holy shit. You know, I got to know more about this and recovery with psychedelics. And, you know, not that I was going to start giving LSD to alcoholics
yeah.
at the time, which I have done since then. Mm-hmm. But I really started looking into it, and that's when Ibogaine came up.
Yeah.
And then a mutual friend of a friend of mine, I had a sponsor in AA, and like 2 weeks before I did the LSD, I was going to start doing step work with him. And he came to me and said, look, Gareth, I'm sorry, I can't be your sponsor. I've just started drinking ayahuasca, and I'm not going to be doing the Alcoholics Anonymous thing anymore. And so I did the LSD thing a couple of weeks later, and then we're talking because we started hanging out, still we carried on hanging out. And yeah. he said, oh, you know, a mutual friend of ours has relapsed. And I said, well, he should be doing, he's relapsed yeah, right. on heroin and methamphetamine. And I said, well, he needs to do Ibogaine.
Yeah.
You know, and he said, what's Ibogaine?
Right, because so, you learned about it.
Yeah, and so we got word to this guy that he needs to do Ibogaine. And so he went off and did Ibogaine down in Mexico. And then went on to become an Ibogaine provider and stuff. And so I was following his treatment mm-hmm. through our mutual friend.
Yeah.
And so when I, you know, found out that everything had been great, his treatment had gone well, you know, he was clean and cleaned him up. I was yeah. like, well, fuck, I've got to go to Canada and start working with Ibogaine.
Yeah.
And this was like 17 or 18 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And so that was my... That was my thing. I'm Canadian born, so I right. was living in the States illegally.
Yeah.
And was just, okay, so I'm going to Canada.
I got a mission now.
I'm on a mission.
Yeah.
And then I met my ex-wife in California, and that kind of all put everything on the back burner for a bit. But it's mm-hmm. always, from that point, it always been, I'm going to Canada, I'm going to start working with Ibogaine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know. So.
So then you came up here and you started helping addicts.
Well, it wasn't quite as simple as that. I got up here about 11 years ago, and my ex-wife and I got married in Vegas. And if we'd got married in Canada, then she could have come here, but it was a whole, we didn't look into it
right.
properly.
Right, you didn't and so, do your research.
No, I didn't do the research, duh. And we come up here to see where we could move.
Yeah.
And coming back into the States, I got busted.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And they said, they threw me back to, they got all mad about something about lack of respect for immigration and taxation laws or something uh-huh. or other.
Yeah.
And told me I could never come back to the States again. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they sent me back to Victoria, and my ex-wife and I had a school bus, a 1955 school bus that we were converting down in California. And so she had to come back and get all of that together and then drive it up at a later date, you know, while I was still left in Canada. So our move to Canada got pushed up kind of, you know,
yeah.
faster as in I wasn't allowed
to go back.
To yeah. go back. Yeah. So I'm yeah. banned from the States. So it was really about getting established here in Canada so that I could import her mm-hmm. as an American. I couldn't be doing Ibogaine and things like that. You have to show that you've got a steady job and you know mm-hmm. so that kind of got put on the back burner for some time. Until such a time as I had an opiate relapse.
Ah. Uh-huh.
Yes. And then I took Iboga or Ibogaine.
Yeah.
Or Iboga, actually. I took Iboga while I was back in the UK.
Right. Let's establish what this stuff is for people who don't know what it is. So this is a root from
yes.
Africa.
Yes.
And the people of Gabon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a country, right?
Yeah.
Gabon.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Sort of in the central east.
Equatorial Africa. West. Equatorial West. Africa.
Yeah. It's in the yeah. west.
It kind of goes in that area from Cameroon, Gabon, and the Congo.
Yeah.
So
it's a plant medicine that's traditionally used by the certain people in Gabon.
It was the forest people that were first using it, pygmies.
Yeah, the pygmies.
Yes.
Right.
And it's been part of their plant medicine pharmacy, if you will. Yeah. You know, it's just been just one of the plants that they use, but it's been a majorly important one, I guess. And, you know, a religion came up out of that. And as I understand it, it was then passed on to their taller neighbors some 400 years ago or uh-huh. something like that, and was adapted. And Bwiti came out of that.
Bwiti,
yeah. Which is a religion.
So this is what you could almost call it a sacrament.
It's
a root that, you know, is turned into a certain type of brew. You drink it or you take it as a powder.
It's the second. It's the root bark, and it's the second root bark on plants that are, I believe, 5 years and older.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the psychoactive.
Yep.
And they use it for initiation into adulthood, and then also for a whole bunch of other things.
Right.
You know, we found using it for ibogaine detoxes, other things get treated at the same time, psoriasis or other ailments. So they use it for a lot of different things, I believe. But I think the main thing is initiation into adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Right, because it creates, so I think people are more familiar with ayahuasca, which creates sort of a psychedelic experience that lasts somewhere between 4 and 6 hours,
mm-hmm.
Disorienting, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Connection to some kind of like a higher power,
mm-hmm.
This feeling of intelligence sort of entering your body.
Plant intelligence.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But iboga, in general, seems it's a longer experience,
mm-hmm.
and it sounds to me, I've never done it, but it sounds to me like a scarier experience, mm-hmm. A little more out of control.
Yeah.
And I never want to do it. Mm-hmm. That's basically when I first heard Aubrey Marcus talking about it, I was like, okay, mm-hmm. not interested in that. It sounds like you had some good insights, but
well, it depends also on dosage. You know, I think with the Bwiti religion, people might take it in one big dose,
uh-huh.
and then they use it in smaller doses after that, mm-hmm. on weekend when they go to the temple and stuff. So
there's iboga, and then there's an extract of iboga
ibogaine.
Called ibogaine.
Yes. So iboga, the root bark, has a lot of different alkaloids in it, between 20 and 12, depending on who you're talking to. But by volume, ibogaine takes up about 50%. And so it's found to be particularly good for opioid detox.
Right.
As opposed to iboga. Working with just ibogaine is slightly easier than working with iboga. Iboga has those other alkaloids in there, and they can cause more nausea. They're more trippy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit heavier on the body.
A little more wily.
Yeah.
Of a spirit.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so I think the last piece that people need to know is that most people know that withdrawal from opiates is one of the most intense, uncomfortable.
It's shitty.
It's really, really bad. And,
yeah.
And people see opiate addiction, the physical part of opiate addiction, it's well known,
mm-hmm.
and we're like, oh, okay, well, so like this is as hard to get off as heroin. Like people will say that because we know that's essentially the strongest addiction that we can find physically.
Mm-hmm.
It creates the longest and most painful
withdrawal symptoms. Yeah.
So ibogaine, the reason why there are ibogaine clinics all around North America, is because
Mexico now,
let's talk about that in a sec. There used to be, at least, there was ibogaine clinics everywhere. Yeah. Is that ibogaine has this quality of being able to neutralize the withdrawal symptoms,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and if it's done in the right way and sort of titrated and used in
there's different ways of working with it. Yeah,
mm-hmm. But people come out the other side with no symptoms,
sure,
feeling clear, unlike any withdrawal they've ever had. Mm. You know, like traditional detox centers, you go there and you're just in agony for 7 days or 10 days and you come out.
And then, you know, a lot of people, not a lot of people, but people can get through the acute withdrawal syndrome, but it's what comes after that gets most people. Mm-hmm. The post-acute withdrawal syndrome. It just goes on for months and months and months.
Uh-huh. And so Ibogaine helps neutralize that
as well. Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, the post-acute withdrawal syndrome is crushing depression, anxiety, insomnia, malaise. You just feel like shit. Really. And that can go on for months and months, particularly the longer somebody's been using opiates and the heavier the doses, mm-hmm. then the longer the pause goes on for post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Yeah, and so that's why a lot of people relapse. You know, even if they get through the kick and they might do well for a period of time and they just want a breath of fresh air. And so they use and then they rewire themselves again.
So you're still underwater basically for months.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where Well, one of the most efficient parts of Ibogaine is that how it carries people through the months afterwards.
Yeah, right. So there's a neurotransmitter thing that's happening here. Mm-hmm. There's a reset that's happening where,
which is kind of difficult to explain. We're not exactly sure what's going on there because, of course, there hasn't been the kind of studies that we need to know. But we know anecdotally.
The results are clear. I've watched a number of documentaries on Ibogaine treatment, and it's crazy how many people come out the other side and stay clean for a long period of time, whereas the relapse rate for opiate addicts is it's near 100%. It's one of the most impossible addictions to kick. So Ibogaine is doing something very special. That's obvious. Why isn't there, especially right now, where we've got just like millions of people addicted to opiates and dozens of people dying every day from overdose because we've got regular people who went to the doctor for pain in their back, who got addicted to OxyContin, are now using heroin.
Yeah,
we're talking about the bus driver and the dentist.
Yeah, no, a lot of the heroin addicts that we have now, and I was seeing the statistics in the States now is something like 4 out of 5 heroin addicts now got there through their doctor.
Yes,
and oxycodone. You know, and then also this is what they do is that they'll work with people to a certain point, and then if they think that there's addiction or dependency, then they go, "Oh, you're an addict now."
They cut them off.
Yeah, I can't. And by law, they have to do that. And by law, then you can go on opioid replacement therapy, methadone or Suboxone,
which is highly addictive as well.
Which is much more addictive.
Yeah, people stay on methadone for life.
Yeah, yeah. Once you get put on methadone or Suboxone, you know, a lot of people just know that, that's it then.
Why don't we have Ibogaine clinics on every corner, you know?
Good question. Because a pharmacist downtown, if they're refilling your methadone script, I think that's worth $6,000 a year to them.
A year, yeah, right. It's very profitable.
So it's pretty lucrative, right? And just think about the company that's providing the methadone. Mm-hmm. And a Suboxone doctor, well, he's got a special license to prescribe Suboxone, which he gets going to the special course that they do for Suboxone doctors. Mm-hmm. So if you're a Suboxone doctor, then you can charge more money for the Suboxone. I've known people in the States that don't have insurance are actually paying more money now to their Suboxone doctor for their fucking Suboxone script than they were to their drug dealer before.
That's disgusting. So they're just switching one for the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But those long-acting opiates, I can see why that they give them, and it's harm reduction, and they do work for some people. Mm-hmm. With the Suboxone, shitty drug, but for some people work well on it, and there's a blocking agent in there that stops them from using other opiates on top.
Right.
And the methadone some people work well with it, but a lot of people use on top as well. And the methadone is very toxic, makes people very lethargic. You know, people fall asleep in their cornflakes in the morning and stuff. And it was created by the Nazis, actually. Cause,
methadone was.
Yeah. Because the Brits had all of the opium kind of tied up, you know, in the production of opium. So the Nazis knew that, because we had India and everything, and the Germans didn't have those access to those areas. So they knew if they were going to take on the world, then they needed a painkiller, and they came up with methadone.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that.
So, yeah.
So
it's been around for a long time.
So, yeah, speaking of keeping people hooked on Suboxone, methadone.
Okay, so that's a financial... There's an industry.
Yeah.
And you think about all of the people now that are on methadone and Suboxone and more, right? Since the oxycodone thing.
Yep.
Now there's a lot of people on replacement therapy. Well, that's a bit of a cash cow for the industry.
It's been very good for them. Yeah. Yeah. That I hate to believe those kinds of, like, it almost sounds like a conspiracy theory.
Well, it's not a conspiracy. It's not. It's just the system.
Because it's just economics.
Yeah. And,
right?
And exactly. And so then I think it costs something like $1 billion to bring a new medicine to to be distributed. Yeah. And in many respects, like, a society as a whole doesn't really give a fuck about people with addiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once you're an addict,
then that's it. Then you're in a different, like, class B or something. We don't give a fuck about you anymore. You only got to look at the downtown east side to see that and how society just in general goes.
There's a lot of judgments about addiction.
Yeah. And so, you know, and I can see drug companies not wanting to be associating with that population. It's a population that has a higher death rate and stuff. And so there isn't the drive to get something like that to market.
Yeah, right. We don't have powerful enough people sort of shouting from the rooftops and putting a lot of money behind bringing a solution to this issue. We have some lawsuits going on between like class action lawsuits between a lot of participants in users of oxys. Of opiates.
Well, and that's another problem we have as well, that they've got opioid phobia, which is another situation now where they're not giving people opioids that should be getting them.
Right.
Because of this whole knee-jerk reaction to the situation.
Yeah. So it's a big mess.
It's a big fucking mess. Yeah, huge mess.
I got some more context on this and, when I watched a documentary called Dosed. D-O-S-E-D, which you were in, and this is how I found you.
Right.
Really great documentary that is for right now not super easy for people to find, but there are screenings in different cities around the world. They're sort of on the film festival / private screening tour right now and gathering funding.
Yeah, it's making it to more places, more and more. And they've just got it picked up another distributor, I think. So,
but for folks who are able to see this film, it's very good. And it shows, it follows one West Vancouver gal who by all means looks normal and you know, just all things appear normal, and she's like, I'm a heroin addict. Mm-hmm. I'm an addict for all things opiates. And it follows her journey from the brink of suicide. She's like, I'm either going to kill myself or I need something huge here to break me through. And she embarks on this journey looking mostly for psychedelics initially, like I need a mental breakthrough. And Ibogaine crosses her path, and I won't spoil anything, but this story really illuminates how, like, number one, the power of Ibogaine and psychedelics in helping addicts heal, and find long-term recovery, and two, helping people break through some of the judgments around addiction, because this woman is, she's both, right? She's like your next door neighbor, and she's also the junkie.
Yeah, she's functioning. You know, she was holding a job down during that time, at the same time having to take methadone, and she was also using on top and stuff, and she doesn't have the appearance of somebody that, you know, that you stereotypically would think of somebody being like that as society, as we have our that picture in our head of an opiate user, heroin addict.
Dose, I think it's dosedmovie.com. I'll have those guys on my show eventually once they're on a larger platform. But what else can we tell people about how Ibogaine works and how they can... A lot of desperate people are going to be listening to this, wanting to find a solution. I have a ton of clients who are dealing with opiate addictions, and you know the numbers of people that are looking for assistance with opiate addiction. How can people get access to good treatment with Ibogaine?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, at the moment, now in Canada, the situation's changed. So it's a prescription medicine only in Canada, which quite a few of the clinics have closed down now because it would be illegal to be giving somebody a boga.
Well,
in
like
Canada now,
what does the prescription look like?
I think it's Health Canada has created it as a prescription medicine only, but that's in their, they can't deny that it has medical value.
Right. Okay. Because before this classification,
it was a unlicensed natural health product
10 years ago.
Yeah, or actually 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And then it got changed into a new category.
So you had clinics in Canada. I knew of one in Calgary, and there were some here.
Yeah.
And so people were able to administer Ibogaine or Iboga.
But the laws changed now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So Health Canada came in.
Yeah.
It created this classification. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can understand why. There are some health risks involved with taking Ibogaine. If you can imagine, it has a tremendous amount of power to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And to pull people off of really high doses of opiates that they've been on for many, many years. So if it has that kind of power to do that amount of good, it also has the power to do some damage if it's given to the wrong people at the wrong time.
In the wrong context.
Yes.
Yeah.
Certain people can't take Ibogaine. And also there's a whole bunch of drugs that cannot be taken with Ibogaine.
Right.
It's very unique. And so I can understand Health Canada's stance on that. It doesn't really change the situation. What needs to happen is that trials need to be done, around that. But then we're getting back to how it's going to be taken or be accepted by the medical community as a whole,
What my hope is for the future is that following this psychedelic revolution that's occurring with primarily MDMA and psilocybin, that Ibogaine will follow suit, and ayahuasca as well. I mean, the other day, Mark Hayden sent a link to Gwyneth Paltrow's new show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she has an episode exploring psychedelics. So there's a lot of hope there, and you've got guys like Tim Ferriss talking about this. You've got Ghost.
Oh, and Michael Pollan's book.
Yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, so the whole thing about psychedelics is becoming very mainstreamed. And so, yes, that's the thing that we would hope that will come out of Dosed is that people are going to start a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and our elected officials need to be growing some political balls and doing the right thing stuff like this.
This happens eventually. I mean, like, look at what's happened with cannabis, right?
Yeah. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah.
It is a matter of time. And I believe that in maybe as short a time as 10 years from now, people will be treated for opioid dependency with Ibogaine.
In medical establishments or medically
supported establishments. It doesn't have to be in a strict hospital environment, but it could be more safely done in a medically supported environment.
You need
somewhere in between the two. You know.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So clearly, we're not recommending that people go out and buy a bunch of Ibogaine.
No. When people take Ibogaine, we have rigorous tests done, 12-lead EKG, liver function test, and blood work, which is kind of like a Polaroid snapshot of people at the time. You know, unfortunately, we're working with people that are experiencing addiction, then people are not often in the best physical shape as well. So all of these things are stuff that have to be taken into consideration.
Yeah.
You know, when working with people, if they're going to be working with something like Iboga or Ibogaine for addiction purposes.
Yeah. You
know, so. Yeah.
But I'm assuming your success rate is really good with people.
That really depends. And people ask me, you know, what's your success rate like? And I think there's a lot of variations that go into that. The Betty Ford Clinic could be really good to somebody at the right time in their life. So generally, though, I prefer to work with people over 35.
Mm-hmm.
I just find that by the time you've reached 35, there isn't a lot of romance left going on.
Yeah.
And also, what's the plan? I find, and I tell people this on the phone, it's all very well taking Ibogaine or Iboga, but what are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
And it should be treated as a tool at the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
not a be all and end all, because it's not.
Not a magic pill.
No, it's not. And unfortunately, the internet can be a bit like that around a lot of psychedelics.
Yeah.
Really. And as we know that they work anecdotally, we don't know a whole great deal about the science behind them at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of, you know, like the internet, for want of a better analogy, is kind of like a rosy nipple sitting on top of a big boob of people that have taken Ibogaine.
Yeah.
But it's the rosy nipple that you see on the internet.
Right.
You know? And everybody wants the rosy nipple.
Yeah.
And the rest of the big boob is, you know, those people that took Ibogaine didn't quite get the rosy nipple thing. Yeah. And they, you know, not that it didn't work or something, but not in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so I find that people need to remember it's a tool at the end of the day. And successful treatments come about from a good plan.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ibogaine is just a part of that plan. You know, I work with some therapists at the Ibogaine Counseling Services, so it's not just me in the medicine. They're working with some therapists, and then also I ideally like to get people to aftercare afterwards. You know, we just wouldn't normally just put somebody through detox and go, okay, you're all good.
Right. So you know, Ibogaine is like a detox with a psychedelic breakthrough, ideally.
You know, and I don't, that breakthrough thing, I find, you know, when I had a very powerful Iboga experience, the breakthrough or a lot of the realization, you know, really comes afterwards. In the clarity that comes afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And not, I don't put too much emphasis on the quote unquote trip itself.
Yeah.
My trip was just awful.
Right.
And it was all about drinking. And even though I'd had an opiate relapse, there was very little about that in my experience. I remember a strong voice saying to me, "Don't do drugs, you fucking dumbass." But I'd already been telling myself that for a week anyhow, you know? So it's like, thanks, I already know thanks. That, you know.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But the what came afterwards was the clarity that I had afterwards, and that's where I learned the most. Mm-hmm. Not really during the trip itself, and often the Ibogaine or Iboga trip can be very confusing. And that's because a lot of reward pathways are being rerouted.
Yeah.
And so a lot of it didn't really make a lot of sense mm-hmm. to me. And it works in a different manner than a lot of other classic tryptamines. Because it is a tryptamine. It's a tryptamine like dimethyltryptamine or LSD, psilocybin.
And ayahuasca is
Exactly. Yeah. But it's also an oneric. And an oneric is a waking daydream. So it's really like really heavy daydreaming.
Uh-huh.
That's what it's like. So it doesn't, and it's a dissociative like ketamine. So it's got three things going on. So it's very unique. And before I took it, I had, because of what I'd read on the internet, I had this whole thing in my head of worked out of what it was going to be like and everything. And it was nothing like that whatsoever.
Hmm.
So.
So yeah, the most important question that I'm going to ask you is, you know, let's say I'm the loved one of an opiate addict, or I'm an opiate addict myself. Mm-hmm. I live in the US or Canada, mm-hmm. and clearly I'm going to have to travel to get an Ibogaine treatment. What do I do? Where do I look?
Yeah, well, we can't legally give anybody Ibogaine now in Canada, as the laws have changed.
And in the US,
so it's Schedule 1 in the US. Okay. It's not. There has been some decriminalization happening in a few cities, mm-hmm. but I don't know. And Iboga is in that decriminalization, but I don't think there's any clinics popping up at the moment or anything like that.
I watched a documentary about a place somewhere in Florida, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure how long ago. It was a Vice. I think it was a Vice documentary. I'm not
about
sure
ayahuasca?
How long. It was about Ibogaine.
Oh.
A clinic.
Oh. Oh, okay.
But it may have been.
Yeah.
Maybe it's legal and they're just covering it. I don't know.
No, I don't think no.
So, okay. Yeah. So you can't find.
So most of the clinics are in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there were some in Costa Rica, but I think they've changed some laws around Iboga as well in Costa Rica. So, most of it's in Mexico.
Is there like a online resources? Just get on Google.
The internet. Yeah, you do. People Google Ibogaine therapy.
Yeah.
And then there's another one. My Iboga is a site which has a listing for Ibogaine providers in North America.
Yeah,
there's a little bit of stuff going on in Europe, in Portugal.
Yeah,
but
right, yeah, because Portugal had a huge drug problem, yep. Yeah. A lot of IV heroin use, yeah. And they, for those who don't know, Portugal tried something that. Basically, no one else had really tried to that point.
Yeah.
And they legalized all drugs.
Decriminalized
all drugs.
Yeah.
And so you can't throw someone in jail for using drugs there. But what happens if you're, you know, out of sorts and you're on the street and the cops pick you up, but they take you to what they call the drug czar, and you have a conversation with this drug czar, which is basically a counselor, and they help you find treatment. And they've redirected all of their money that they had devoted towards going like the drug war,
mm-hmm.
and they've redirected it towards treatment.
Yeah.
And in the last, I don't know, was it 10 years? It was more than 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. And I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, but they did have the worst HIV and the worst drug use in Europe at one point.
Yeah.
And now I think they have the lowest.
It's just been a total downward, upside down, what's that? Hockey stick curve, right? Mm-hmm. When things are growing, it's like been like that on the other direction. So very inspiring stuff what Portugal has done. So if people want to get a hold of you and they want to maybe get your recommendation or mm-hmm. work with you in Mexico, mm-hmm. Where do they go?
I can be found in Inner Realm Center online, and
is it innerrealms.ca or .com?
Innerrealmscenter.com.
Innerrealmscenter.com.
Yeah. And center spelled ER like the American way and not the Canadian way.
Right. Center. Yeah. Anything else you want people to know about Ibogaine or opiate addiction that we haven't covered?
Well, yeah, as I was saying, you know, it's good to have a good plan in place. And we have a few different places where we like people to go post-treatment. And they're Ibogaine aftercare places. And so then the people that you would be sharing those spaces would be people that have come from other Ibogaine treatment centers. Mm-hmm. We found that the traditional rehab places are not really the sort of places where you'd want your Ibogaine clients to go, because they're in a completely different space than somebody who hasn't done an Ibogaine treatment. And I haven't gone through traditional rehab myself. I realize it's not really the best thing that we can do for people going through that thing at the time. It seems like housing a bunch of people that don't have access to their drug of choice, and they're sitting around talking war stories, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee.
Right.
And somebody who's come through an Ibogaine treatment is in a completely different space.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't want them rubbing shoulders with people that haven't had an Ibogaine experience.
Yeah.
You know? And in an ideal world where we didn't have to worry about resources, People would go for an Ibogaine treatment and then they would go to somewhere for aftercare for up to 90 days.
Right.
I tend to work over in lower doses over a 2 week period, but it means that I get an awful lot of Ibogaine into people. Mm-hmm. And I find that the noribogaine is the metabolite that floats around after it's metabolized through the liver. It floats around in the system. And that is really what holds people as the addiction interruption. And so the more medicine I can get into people, the longer it holds them. Mm. And normally we get a 2 to 3 month period with that. And it's not that after 2 or 3 months, you know, you wake up in withdrawal or something like that. But I remember how it was myself at kind of the 3 month mark. I woke up one morning and I was like, there's not quite so much of it in me. Uh-huh. And I felt that I didn't have quite the protection. So what happens, you know, is life comes around and you have to face life on life's terms.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's when the real work begins.
Yeah.
You know.
And so you need I like what you're saying about like have a plan, because like yeah. you can go and get an Ibogaine treatment, but yeah. you still need the community that yeah. you're talking about yeah. that's yeah. going to. Yeah. See you, well, be with you, reflect back to you.
And it's in that period, those 3 months, where people can do them, are most open to receiving the information that's being shown to them, or working with a therapist. That's a kind of a window of opportunity.
Right.
Where you can go deep. So to make positive change in your life.
Yeah.
In an easier fashion than it ever has been before.
Yeah.
Because of the power of the medicine.
And 90 days is a really good length of time to practice a new way of living.
Yeah.
Like
the neuroplasticity of the brain as well, mm-hmm. you know, new pathways.
Right. You've opened a lot of things up
yeah.
in that experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. And I think people need to, I've said this before, but I think people really need to know that you cannot recover from addiction in a week.
No.
You know, you can detox from yeah. your drug of choice in a yeah. week, but you have to repattern new ways of living. And yeah. that takes a long time, especially for someone who's been using for 15 or 20 or 25 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the research shows that the longer a person goes to treatment, any treatment, you know, never mind opiate addiction, all addictions, the longer the treatment, the higher the success rate.
Yeah.
And we have a standard in North America that's 28 days yeah. because that's what insurance companies want right. to cover, yeah. but that's not evidence-based.
Sure.
So people need to know, like, the 28-day thing is bullshit, mm-hmm. and 90 days is way better. And if you can find yeah. six-month treatment, go
yeah.
for it,
yeah.
right? Because yeah. you need to spend time in community with people who are also doing the same thing that you're doing for as long as you possibly can. I went to rehab for a year,
right?
And I had only been using for, like, 3 years.
Yeah.
But it was very effective yeah, for me, yeah. obviously. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I recommend that for other people. I've worked at treatment centers that are 90 days and the success rate is much better. We yeah. have yeah, just much higher success with people. So yes, have a plan. Don't just go to get detoxed and think that you're going to change your life and yeah. go back to your, you know, you go away to Mexico, you do an Ibogaine treatment and then they ship you back home
yeah.
to, let's say you're living with your parents.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like you'll go live with your parents, you same old people on the street corner,
and everything.
Triggers everywhere. Yeah, 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 like yeah. good luck, man. You're yeah. going to waste your week in Mexico.
Yeah. Well, you know, right? it can happen like that people are like, they feel like they don't want to use.
Yeah.
And that's another thing is that the Ibogaine can work so efficiently. They're like, oh, I'm fucking cured.
Right.
Which is nothing further from the truth. It just means you didn't think about drugs for 3 months and then suddenly
yeah.
something happened. Life comes around, slaps you in the face. And our MO is to go fucking use unless you've done something in that period of time,
mm-hmm.
you know, done some work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You need a safe container. I watched a really good video once for like an hour where this guy was just talking about triggers and how uh-huh. addicts deal with triggers, and how you recover from a trigger, et cetera. And basically the moral of what he was saying was addicts actually, they don't learn to get rid of their triggers. They learn to slowly deal with their triggers and their stress.
Mm-hmm.
And you start at level 1 out of 10, you know, you deal with that level 1 out of 10 trigger, which is just, you know, maybe just the thought while you're in treatment, you know, you go talk about it and you know, do this or that and you move mm-hmm. through that. But maybe like, yeah, seeing an old person or an old place, in your hometown is like a six or a seven, and you need to work your way up to that and practice, and and you really need a community for that, and you need time.
So
have a plan.
And I've treated people more than once, and it's not because the Ibogaine didn't work. It's because they didn't stick to their plan, or they had a shitty plan, didn't stick to their plan. And also, you know, we tend to learn the hard way or something, or try and wiggle our way out the easier way, and then, fuck, that's not going to work. So it can be back to the drawing board, and I have treated people more than once, and it's like, you know, it's not something that people get just like that as well, you know, and that's getting out of addiction is not a straight line or anything. It's a lot of up and down and two steps forward and one step back, and you know, as we learn.
Yeah, that magic pill thinking.
Yeah, no,
it still hangs on, you know. Yeah. Like I still have that from time to time, and and it's kind of like the last thing to go, and but that's the ticket to longer term recovery, is how much can you let go of that magic bullet or magic pill thinking that like you're going to do this one thing and it's going to change you forever. Like there is a daily maintenance required for any change in the human system. And you have to accept that at a deep level and realize like you don't get through life, you know, for free in a sense. Like you need to work for whatever you want to create in your life. Yep. And things like Ibogaine or ayahuasca help that.
Yes. Yeah.
You know?
And that, I've found that with our clients, the ones that have done the best are those that have picked up plant medicine afterwards. You know, not like magic bullets or anything like that, but it's a deeper check-in with yourself that we don't normally have access to. And there's also, as uncomfortable as that might be, because, you know, for opiate people especially, you know, they prefer that kind of shut down opiate thing, and going to ayahuasca is all like being blown open, or working with psilocybin. It's like, oh, fuck, you know, you get your ass served up to you on a plate, and
your ego gets really exposed.
Yeah.
Really exposed.
But you know, a lot of healing happens during that, that stuff. So,
Yeah. I think it's our mutual friend, Mark, who runs Ibogasol.
Mark
was telling me that, you know, because we were having another conversation with a guy who came up to him and said, hey, like, I'm interested in Iboga. You know, I've been in recovery for, you know, a few years now. And, and we were both sort of saying to him, like, well, you know, like, actually, Iboga's, it's good for the roots. It's good for the foundation. It's actually good early on in recovery. Yeah. It's like the roots of the tree. Ayahuasca and mushrooms are actually more like the top level above the soil. Like, you know, a few years into recovery, like... That's a good time to get into ayahuasca.
And I also think that psilocybin is a better, you know, or can be more illuminating than something like Iboga. If you're not getting off of opiates or something, or if it's not addiction, then, you know, somehow the psilocybin is,
I've had good success working with guys in a retreat format, 7 days, isolated on a diet, detoxing, sauna, breath work, qigong, closed group sessions with ayahuasca. But these are all guys who have some clean time. Like they're not in the very beginning of their recovery. Sure. Some of these guys are past 10 years and like fantastic results because they're in a space where they're ready for that next level of opening. Yeah. They're not just trying to like deal with an acute issue. Yeah, I think these things are good adjuncts for each other when used at the right time. Great. Okay. So
also, really awesome. Nutrition's pretty important in our thing as well. You know.
Yeah. How does that
while we're working with somebody?
How does that play into it?
Blair, a lot of people come in on 7-Eleven diets.
Yeah, right.
You know, the 7-Eleven dieta.
Yeah. And, nachos and hot dogs.
Yeah. And so we focus on juices. So there's a kind of a juice detox going on. And then Blair, my girlfriend, she's doing a lot of support food-wise as well, and doing smoothies. And we're vegans ourselves, but we, you know, we do provide meat for people should they want it. Mm-hmm. But so, generally speaking, there's quite an emphasis on healthy food, you know, and finding some healthier things for people to eat. Mm-hmm. And people are respond well.
I bet.
Well, yeah. the Ibogaine, it detoxes people on a lot of different levels. And sugar. In some respects, yeah, some people can't do sugar afterwards.
Right.
In some respects, it's almost a bit of a sideshow, the opiate detox, mm-hmm. as it's kind of showing you in other ways of really how to take care of yourself. Mm. People often quit tobacco as well while they're with us. Not always.
Yeah.
Can get people off the heroin, but some people just can't quite drop the cigarettes, mm-hmm. which is fine, one thing at a time. But often, after a couple of days of low dosing, people are like, ugh, these things taste horrible. And so the sugar and the shit food and mm-hmm. things like that, that, you know, so that's also an important part. Like if people aren't getting the right nutrition, then they're not firing on all cylinders and that can lead to drug use or slipping back into drug use as well. So,
mm-hmm. so you're, yeah, you're detoxing a lot of things from the body mm-hmm. and then you're loading people up with nutrients that mm-hmm. they, in some cases have not had in like decades, yeah. right? Like if you're giving people juices.
You know, especially alcohol as well, it's very difficult to get nutrition, you know? Yeah. People don't, it's just, yeah. They're not receiving it and the alcohol's kind of washing it out.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So, yeah, this was awesome. Thank you for mm-hmm. Educating people on this topic. Thank you for doing the work that you do. I know that sure. like, you know, a 10-day or 2-week Ibogaine treatment working with someone is a really intense, high level of one-to-one work. It's a high level of attention you give to one person. And, but I'm sure that you've, you know, assisted in saving so many people's lives through the work that you've done. So yeah, thanks for giving back to your community.
You're quite welcome. It's our clients that do all the hard work, yeah. really. They're the ones that do the hard work with the medicine mm-hmm. and we're the kind of the support team
yeah.
that knows when to apply it and, you know, when to take rest and stuff like that. But yeah, really at the end of the day, it's the clients that do all the real hard work, yeah. you know, with the medicine and stuff. And like I say, we're their support team.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming in, Gareth. Okay. Gareth Moxie, innerrealmscenter.com. Thanks so much, man.
Okay, you're quite welcome.
All right.
Cheers.